This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. You might call the Nobel Prizes the holy grails of science. They're certainly science's most prestigious awards. But there are plenty of other awards out there, and today we're going to hear about the winners of two awards that honor the quirky nature of basic scientific research. Later this hour, we'll hear about the Golden Goose Awards. This year's winners are credited with nothing less than building the foundation for the National Kidney Exchange and enabling the biotechnology revolution. But first, prizes and a ceremony directly intended to spoof the vaunted Nobels. The Ig Nobel Prizes are awarded each year to some of science's most ridiculous-sounding research. The award ceremony at Harvard's Sanders Theater involves paper airplane barrages, moments of science, singing, and lots of laughter. But there's something serious going on underneath it all, and joining us to explain what that is Mark Abrams. Mark Abrams is co-founder and editor of the Annals of Improbable Research, formerly the Journal of Irreproducible Results. He's author of This is Improbable and the father and master of ceremonies of the Ig Nobel Prizes. The prizes, as well as Mark's work, honor science that makes us laugh, then makes us think. He joins me now from WGBH in Boston. Mark Abrams, welcome to Living Lab.
Good morning.
Now, one of my favorite Ig Nobels, and I've been a fan and a watcher for some time, comes from 2007, determining why pregnant women don't fall over. This was actually a letter to the journal Nature, one of science's most prestigious journals, entitled Fetal Load and the Evolution of Lumbar Lordosis in Bipedal Hominins. So this is real research, and all of the research that's involved in the Ig Nobels is real research, right?
We deal in reality, unlike some people, yes.
But a lot of the kind of making it seem ridiculous is perhaps in the way the research is summarized for the Ig Nobels. Of course, turning that very technically loaded title into Why Pregnant Women Don't Fall Over. Is that your job to kind of pare it all down?
That's part of my job, yeah. We're not making anything ridiculous. There are a lot of things in the world that are very serious and also are very funny at the same time if you happen to look at them clearly.
Let's take an example from this year's winner. The prize for medicine this year went to research assessing the effect of listening to opera on heart transplant patients who happen to be mice. And we actually have a clip of the scientists themselves accepting this award last Thursday night.
Tonight is a great honor for us and for all the persons who are interested in brain and immune system. Using mouse heart transplantation model into the abdomen, we did show the force of music. A famous opera, La Traviata. Generated regulatory cells and prolonged graft survival. We say, we hope and we believe this, our improbable results are immediately used for clinical and our life and make people laugh and then sing.
So we should say that the scientists accepting that award, or at least some of them singing that opera for everybody in Sanders Theater, were actually wearing mouse costumes with big hearts on the front. So there's obviously, as we said, a lot of comedy and laughter going on. But what's the serious side of this?
Well, they really did this work. They're trying to figure out ways to do heart transplants on people and have the people live longer. One of the things that some doctors had wondered about for a while is whether things like music in the air might be able to help. There have been a lot of experiments on things like that. These people did heart transplants on mice. They played some music from La Traviata, and they did heart transplants on other mice playing music from Enya, the I'm not sure how to classify Enya's music.
Yeah, kind of almost Airy. New world trance. I used to do yoga to Enya, but yeah.
Yeah, well, if you have to have a heart transplant, apparently Enya should not be your first choice of music for the surgeons while they're doing it.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, at least it didn't work too well with the mice. But opera music seemed to help quite a bit. They lived longer.
So who picks the winners of the Ig Nobels, and what are some of the criteria?
The Ig Nobel Board of Governors chooses. That's the editors of my magazine, the Annals of Improbable Research, and a bunch of scientists and other people around the world. The criteria is simple. It's that you have done something that first makes people laugh and then makes them think. And that's it. It can be about science or anything else. We also give out a Peace Prize, some years a Literature Prize, all sorts of things. We get something like 9,000 new nominations every year. And we also consider anything that we'd looked at previous years and not chosen. So it's very difficult on the numbers to win an Ig Nobel Prize.
So this doesn't even have to be research just published in the past year. It can be at any point.
And not just research. We gave an Ig Nobel Prize in art about 15 years ago to a man named Don Featherstone, who created the plastic pink flamingo. There is a person who created the plastic pink flamingo.
I never really thought about that.
We also gave the Ig Nobel Prize, in fact, the Ig Nobel Peace Prize 10 years ago to the person who invented karaoke. He is Japanese, as you might expect. We gave him the Peace Prize because by inventing karaoke, he invented an entirely new way for people to learn to tolerate each other.
I guess that is definitely one way of explaining karaoke. This year, you awarded a prize in psychology for research confirming by experiment that people who think they are drunk are also attractive, and their acceptance
no,
speech...
No. It's that people who think they are drunk also think they are attractive.
Oh, so it's not actually being drunk. It's thinking that you're drunk.
Yeah.
So this is really a mind trip.
Yeah, this was the experiments were done in France in a bar.
Well, and I think the French accent makes their acceptance, I guess you could call it speech, but acceptance song that much better.
We hypothesized in Fit 31 that we would find a correlation between perceptions of one's attraction and people's intoxication. Research showed that in coffees and bars, drunk people feel more appealing. Something links what self-perceptions are and etiometric measuring. The next step was to investigate through a method more accurate. We experimented more scholarly to know why those guys feel less ugly. This is the result of the whole story. When good guys feel they are sexy, it's just placebo, very expectancy. Such a belief is a fancy.
Now, at the end there, you hear Miss Sweetie Poo, I believe her name is, saying that she's bored and asking them to stop. That's the Ig Nobel special way of telling people that they've had their time on stage. Where did that come from?
Like any other public awards ceremony or any other public ceremony, we have a problem. We used to have a problem that a lot of the speakers would want to keep talking longer than people really wanted to listen. And we solved that problem a number of years ago. Every year we recruit a really cute 8-year-old girl who we call Miss Sweetie Poo. And Miss Sweetie Poo, whenever she feels somebody has talked long enough, walks up to them on stage and says, "Please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored." As you heard her do there. And they stop.
Eventually.
Well, usually pretty quickly. I must say, this is the first year that any of the winners have decided to sing their acceptance speeches. I'm not sure it's a good trend.
Well, it certainly got everybody's attention, I think.
I mean,
the Ig Nobel ceremony seems to be, I don't know, kind of taking shots at or poking fun at more than just the Nobel Prizes. I mean, you've got, in addition to Miss Sweetie Poo to get people off stage, you've got your V-chip monitoring all the content. You've got a couple of people that were on stage painted gold, wearing gold kind of sequiny bikinis, holding flashlights.
Those are our human spotlights. They illuminate the proceedings.
And are they gold to look like Oscars or...?
No, it just seemed like something useful. You need to have some light up there so people can see. And that concept of the human spotlight was invented by an MIT engineer named Jim Brett. Years later, he invented, or he's one of the people who invented 3D, three-dimensional printing. So He invents all sorts of things.
Indeed. In case you're just joining us, this is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone, and I'm talking with Mark Abrams, MC of the Ig Nobel Prize ceremony, which took place last Thursday. Now, Mark, the joint prize in biology and astronomy this year, I remember when this research came out earlier this year, went to an international team for discovering that when dung beetles get lost, they can navigate their way home by looking at the Milky Way. It's not necessarily research that seems to have a lot of practical application, but it certainly has, you know, gee whiz appeal. It got a lot of press. What about it in particular was it that struck you that this research was worthy of an Ig Nobel?
Did it make you laugh?
Well, I guess it did. But it certainly made me think, could other animals use the Milky Way?
Well, that's why. Yeah. So you're saying it's not practical. If you were a dung beetle, this is quite practical.
Well, that's...
And also, if you want to know how nervous systems behave, maybe this tells you something about nervous systems you hadn't really understood before. And who knows? You know, maybe the same thing doesn't quite happen in humans. Maybe we can't navigate so well from the Milky Way, although maybe we can. But anyway, just the fact that this is possible, it's going on in nervous systems. If you were a scientist who wanted to understand nervous systems, this might make you wonder and look in directions you haven't quite looked in.
You know, I think one of the questions that always occurs to me looking at a lot of these projects anyway is, how did they come up with that idea?
Yes, the fact that that it makes you and everybody else wonder that way is... That's a big part of why we chose these particular things to win Ig Nobel Prizes.
So the archaeology prize, I think, had to be one of my favorites. And I'm actually going to let you describe the research that won the archaeology prize this year.
All right. So it went to two scientists, Brian Crandall and Peter Stahl. They won for parboiling a dead shrew and then swallowing that shrew without chewing it, and then carefully examining everything that was excreted over the next few days. They did this all to see which bones would dissolve inside the human digestive system and which bones would not.
That is some serious dedication to science, and I can't take credit for this, but a coworker, when I described this last week, said, well, they certainly tamed the shrew.
I wrote about this a couple years ago. I do a newspaper in... column in a newspaper in England. I came up with a headline that I'm proud of, although they changed the headline. But I called this "The Tasting of the Shrew."
I can't say that I ever wanted to know what parboiled shrew tasted like. But in accepting the prize, the researchers, I think I was perhaps expecting a lot of grandstanding, and you know, this seemed like one of the more ridiculous bits of research. But in fact, the acceptance speech in this case took a rather heartfelt turn.
We are duplicating the study, and we will be recruiting volunteers outside. We're moving bigger now. I actually did this research when I was an undergraduate 20 years ago, so I'm glad finally some recognition came. But but this reflects my approach to science, which is to not force it. Embrace the mystery of it, pursue it with passion, and just have fun. My current job is outside of the university setting. I actually teach science to kids. I get hired to travel to schools and spark an interest in science in children while they're young, before they get too old to lose the interest in it. Thank you.
Are children or budding scientists a particularly... keen audience for the Ig Nobels, do you think?
Oh, everybody pretty much seems to be, if they don't hate the idea of it. But there are still a few people wandering around who think that science is too serious to involve anything funny, and it's sort of a sin to laugh at any of this stuff. There aren't that many people. Brian Crandall is the scientist who made that speech about the shrews. He's one of the shrew people. He was being modest in a way. That experiment sounds pretty strange, and I guess it is pretty strange. But here's the result of what they found. archaeologists dig up things. They look at very old things, old bones, old rocks, old whatever, and try to make some sense and tell us the story of what was going on thousands or millions of years ago. And there's a lot of archaeology that comes from people looking at bones, collections of old bones, and they can see here are some human bones all together and here are some little tiny bones from a little animal. And the scientists, just by looking at those particular bones and the condition of the bones, come up with the story of, oh, this animal is obviously part of the diet. This is what people ate 20,000 years ago or 500,000 years ago. We can tell from the bones. What this experiment shows is a lot of those assumptions about the bones are wrong. They expected that all the big bones would pass completely through the person and come out unharmed. What they discovered was an awful lot of even the big bones disappeared, got dissolved, and never came out as bones. So what this says is that an awful lot of what people know, think they know about archaeology, about the old days, about what people ate long, long ago, an awful lot of what they know may be wrong.
Well, would we assume that people long ago would actually have been eating the bones of the shrews, eating them whole?
Well, I'm not sure whether people ate shrews often or not, but certainly anything with bones that people ate, the bones were left behind, you hope. This experiment shows that, no, maybe they weren't. Maybe a lot of those bones didn't get left behind. and the same is true of if you're of animals. If you're trying to figure out what did the woolly mammoth eat, you know, there are places where they have heaps of bones of woolly mammoths, and some of those have little heaps of bones of tiny, tiny animals that obviously were eaten by the woolly mammoths. But you can't make the assumptions you used to make. A lot of what people thought they knew may not be so.
So questioning assumptions. Now, there are actual Nobel Prize winners who take part in the ceremony. Obviously, they don't think that science has to be serious and stodgy all the time. How do some of these folks get involved?
I invite them and they come. That's pretty much the whole story.
So it's just a matter of asking and finding the folks with the right sense of humor. Has anybody ever said, no, I don't really care to take part in this making fun of science?
Oh, yeah. There have been a few people. There are some Nobel laureates who said that entertainment is not part of science, and laughter is not useful to science, and amusement is not useful. In fact, though, most scientists have a pretty strong sense of humor, and they have to, because science is, for most scientists, a very frustrating job. They're trying to understand things nobody else has been able to understand. And that means that most of the time their work day after day is going to be really frustrating. They're going to go down blind ends. They're going to make mistakes. If they can't laugh about it, at least to themselves, they're not going to be happy people. But most of them joke around a lot. They just don't always show it in public.
What about the prize winners? Have you ever offered an Ig Nobel to someone who got offended and refused?
Occasionally. In almost every case, we quietly offer the prize to people and let them turn down this honor if they want to. But almost everybody decides to accept. Every once in a while, there's somebody who is offended, who tells us that their work is too important for people to be amused at. And that's fine. We don't give them the prize. The more common thing, and it doesn't happen that often, but the more common thing when somebody turns it down is it turns out they are very young. They're at the start of their career. They happen to work for a boss who doesn't like them, and they simply want to endure and get through the next few years quietly and move someplace else. In some of those cases, we got back in touch with them 5 years later. We offered them the prize, and they happily accepted.
Well, this year there was a safety engineering prize, which, if anything, sounds unreal. This actually has a U.S. patent, but doesn't sound like it could possibly be real. It's an anti-hijacking system for aircraft.
Mm-hmm. And let me mention the patent number. Anybody can go to the internet and get a copy of this. It's U.S. patent number 3811643. That's U.S. patent number 3811643. Just Google it. You can download it and see the pictures. This was a prize that we awarded to the late Gastano Pizzo, who lived in New York City. We got in touch with his siblings, who are still alive, and they were pleased that he was being honored. Mr. Pizzo invented an electromechanical system to trap airplane hijackers. This system drops a hijacker through trap doors in the floor of the plane. It seals him into a package automatically, and then it drops that encapsulated hijacker through the airplane's specially installed bomb bay doors, from which point the encapsulated hijacker parachutes to Earth, where police, who have been alerted by radio, are there waiting for him to arrive.
And we should say this patent actually comes from 1972. This isn't some sort of post 9/11 response to airplane hijackings. This is something that dates back 40 years.
Yeah, and there was epidemic is almost the word of hijackings in the 1960s and early 70s. Usually, it was people hijacking planes and demanding to be taken to Cuba. And in the early 1970s, the U.S. government asked the public to come up with ideas to do something about this. And apparently, Mr. Pizzo felt moved patriotically to come up with something. In fact, there's a wonderful book that's just been published about those hijackings. It's called The Skies Belong to Us, and it's a history of that, although it doesn't mention Mr. Pizzo.
Unfortunately. There were we're not going to have time to get through every prize on its own, but let's see here. A quick rundown of what's left. There was a physics prize for discovering that some people would be physically capable of running across the surface of a pond if those people and that pond were on the moon. And one of my favorites, a probability prize for discovering that the longer a cow has been lying down, the more likely that cow is to soon stand up. And that once a cow stands up, you can't easily predict how soon that cow will again lie down. So why should we honor research like this that sounds in some cases quite preposterous?
Look at it from a different direction. Everybody, and I mean everybody, does things in their work, in their daily life that are important to them, or at least obligatory. And if they were to describe in detail what they do every moment to anybody else, it would seem ridiculous. You know, even somebody who, say, is an accountant, if they describe what they're doing moment by moment, it seems kind of crazy. Some things are crazy and sane at the same time. Some things are funny and serious at the same time. And there's nothing in the world, or there are very few things in the world that pay attention to anything outstanding. You know, there are, 7 billion people in the world? And almost anybody who does something, no matter how wonderful or how terrible it is never, ever going to get much notice from the rest of the world. So the Ig Nobel Prizes, they're not important, but we pick out 10 people or 10 groups who've done things that are really staggering, that lodge in your mind. They're funny, and then they make you think. And we were able to get them at least a little bit of attention.
So do you think that the Ig Nobel Prizes, in terms of the general public, are something that is the intention to make science more human, more appealing, more accessible? Or do you think that this could backfire and really turn some people off to science?
I don't want to predict what goes on inside the head of any particular person, but again, what we're trying to do is simply make people laugh and then think at things that they wouldn't have noticed otherwise. So we're hoping that here and there people will hear about some of these prizes and get really curious about what was going on. You know, we're telling you just the boiled down version of the story. The details in every case are much, much more interesting and fun than what we've given here.
I mean, you've made a whole career essentially out of celebrating this, you know, the sometimes ridiculous sounding side or the wacky side of research. You yourself started off as a mathematician and computer programmer. How did you get started down this track?
Well, I was doing this kind of thing when I was a little kid, too.
It goes way back.
I'm really, everything I'm doing now, I was doing one way or another when I was about 10 years old. And I was doing it as part of my work, even when I was a programmer or working on math stuff.
Do you have a favorite Ig Nobel Prize?
I have a lot of favorites. We've been doing this every year, 10 prizes a year since 1991. I'll mention one of them because it's led in so many directions. We don't have time for the whole story of it. But in 2003, we gave the Ig Nobel Prize in Biology to a scientist from the Netherlands. He had noticed something. He studies birds, and he's the curator of a natural history museum in the city of Rotterdam. He noticed something unusual one day. He wrote a report and published it in a very small science journal. Somebody sent us a copy. His report is the first scientifically documented case of homosexual necrophilia in the mallard duck.
Now, I have to tell you, that study was actually my introduction to the Ig Nobels, and I've never forgotten it.
It's led to many things for that scientist and for others. He's become very well known around the world. And within a few years, here's the state of affairs. Around the world, there are a lot of scientists, especially biologists, people who study animals, who when they notice an animal doing something completely outside anything they had imagined being possible, they get in touch with this scientist to let him know, because they figure there's at least one scientist in the world who does want to know about really unusual things and catalog them.
So his Ig Nobel actually jump-started a whole career path for him.
It did. As a result of it, he has been asked to write books, newspaper columns. He's all over radio and television. He's in great demand as a speaker. And it's done very nice things for his museum, too. So this is all just dumb luck that it had that effect. But it's been a happy and kind of sweet thing to see.
The physics prize went to a discovery that some people would be physically capable of running across the surface of a pond, but only if those people and that pond were on the moon. What's that about?
They were looking at gravity. They were trying to figure out what would happen if gravity were not as strong as it were. What would be the effect on people? And they were trying to they knew that if you turn gravity way, way down, you can, you know, walk on water. And so they were trying to measure exactly how much you would have to turn gravity down. They did this by getting a big tank of water and dangling a guy from the ceiling and having him frantically try to walk across the water suspended from a big rubber thing. There's video, which is amusing.
Quite. They literally had this guy on kind of a bungee cord and trying to do the impossible.
Yeah, it's the closest thing I've ever seen to a human being who looks like he's a character in a cartoon.
The chemistry prize for discovering that the biochemical process by which onions make people cry is even more complicated than scientists previously realized. What makes it more complicated?
When you cut an onion, a whole series of chemical reactions happen. And the result, the final thing that happens if that stuff comes in contact with your eye, is it provokes tears. As the years have gone by and scientists have tried to look carefully at, hey, exactly what's going on with what chemicals, they've discovered it's not just one simple thing. One thing happens, then another, then another, then another. People had thought they understood this whole long series of things, and it turned out there was one more step nobody had noticed, and that's what these researchers in Japan discovered.
So again, this is kind of that questioning assumptions theme that we were talking about with the Archaeology Prize as well.
Yeah, and sort of the interesting thing about it is it says yet again, there's more going on inside even an onion than people suspected. Same thing with the human body. There's more going on than anybody really understands yet.
All right, the Probability Prize for discovering or documenting that the longer a cow has been lying down, the more likely that cow will soon stand up, and that once the cow stands up, you can't easily predict how soon that cow will lie down again. I mean, this seems like I can't even imagine what would prompt you to begin looking at this question for your research.
I'll start by saying the scientists told us that until we got in touch with them and offered them this prize, it did not occur to them that what they were doing might seem funny to somebody.
Really?
But the moment they looked at it that way, they decided, yeah, it was pretty funny. They are researchers at a veterinary college in Edinburgh, Scotland. They were trying to find ways to tell when a cow is becoming ill. How can you tell that earlier, days in advance, than it's possible to do now? And the thing, the paper they wrote about the thing they noticed was just one of many things they noticed in that whole process of trying to figure out what is it the cows do when they're healthy, what is it they do when they're sick, how do those patterns change?
Well, and in the acceptance speech, I mean, which was quite funny in and of itself, the researcher says, you know, cows are kind of boring. He pokes fun at himself, but he says, you know, they really expected the cow to be standing up and laying down at kind of regular intervals, and that's not what happened at all.
No, no. So this, here again, nature is full of surprises, some of them really tiny, but there are lots of surprises, and they are surprising.
Now, you, as I understand, are married to a psychologist, Robin Abrams, who writes the misconduct, ethics column for the Boston Globe. What does she think of the Ig Nobels? Are they proper?
Well, she's tolerant of them.
And I guess that's a good thing.
We met because she saw a number of years ago we were looking for a few new volunteers to help out with the ceremony, and she got in touch. She was in graduate school at that time, and she was reaching a point where she had a little bit of spare time, and she had a big theater background, so she wanted to get involved. So, yeah, she seems to think it's okay. She never tells me to please stop. She never says she's bored.
All right. Mark Abrams is co-founder and editor of the Annals of Improbable Research, author of This is Improbable, and master of ceremonies of the Ig Nobel Prizes. Mark, I hope we can do this again next year.
Oh, I'd love to.
You can watch a video of the 2013 Ig Nobel Prize ceremony on our website, capeandislands.org. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk with Barry Toive about the winners of this year's Golden Goose Awards for esoteric-sounding research that has turned out to be incredibly important. Stay with us.
I'm bored. Please talk. I'm bored. Please talk. I'm bored.
Thank you, Miss Sweetie.
I think the interesting thing about this lab is it looks like a mad scientist lab. You walk in here and there's, you know, rows and rows of glass tubing with all these valves and vials, vats of steaming. Well, it is steaming, liquid nitrogen. And then there are us, these kids, running around moving gas from one place to another on these computer screens, basically. So it's a neat lab. Aesthetically, and we do really neat work. I'm Sarah Gaines at the National Ocean Sciences Accelerator Mass Spectrometer Facility in the Sample Preparatory Lab at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and you're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
Welcome back to Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. As we've heard this hour, even real scientific research can sound laughable if summarized the right or perhaps wrong way and maybe taken out of context. And of course, some basic research is rather esoteric. Not everyone appreciates that aspect of science. You may recall then-Governor Sarah Palin's notorious comments during the 2008 election.
Sometimes these dollars, they go to projects having little or nothing to do with the public good. Things like fruit fly research in Paris, France. I kid you not.
Sarah Palin certainly wasn't the first to take aim at basic research. From 1975 to 1988, Senator William Proxmire handed out monthly Golden Fleece Awards for wasteful government spending. Odd-sounding research projects were frequent winners, as was NASA's search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Now there's a new set of awards, the Golden Goose Awards, intended to highlight the importance of federally funded basic research, even esoteric projects that may sound like Ig Nobel contenders. This year's Golden Goose winners are credited with enabling the National Kidney Exchange and the sequencing of DNA. Barry Toive of the Association of American University joins us now to tell us more about the Golden Goose Awards and introduce this year's winners. Welcome, Barry.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So give us a little background on the Golden Goose Awards. This is just the second year, I believe, of the Golden Goose Awards. They were first envisioned by Congressman Jim Cooper of Tennessee. They have a bit of a political background.
Well, that's right. This is the second year. Congressman Cooper used to watch Senator Proxmire make fun of science, and he used to get pretty steamed about it. And he was very concerned that, one, first of all, this was undermining support for science, but particularly that it was going to reduce support for the federal investment in research, which he considered to be very critical. And he came to a number of organizations that that also believe it's very critical. Our association and other university associations, we're the Association of American Universities, but there are several others, and also business groups and scientific organizations like the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and said, you know, you ought to create a Golden Goose Award to show how this sometimes silly-sounding or odd or obscure research often turns into major benefits for society. And last year, we took him up on it.
Well, so what's the significance of the goose part of the name here?
Well, it's a play on the fable of the goose that laid the golden egg, the goose being the federal government's investment in research, the golden eggs being some of the extraordinary benefits that come from that, everything from MRI to the Internet, and GPS and numerous other innovations that we take for granted today, but actually came out of, and we assume that they came from the private sector. And, of course, eventually the work on them does come out of the private sector, but the fundamental research that made them possible comes from the federal investment in research at agencies such as the National Institutes of Health, National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, and others.
So obviously there's some politics involved here in the creation of the Golden Goose Awards, but this is an award that's been, I guess, supported, sponsored, signed on to by some of the top science advocacy groups in the country, including the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Well, that's right, because for our organizations, the benefits are self-evident. But for the public and for policymakers, not necessarily so. And at a time when federal spending is being squeezed, we're deeply concerned that the investment in science will be diminished, and we're concerned that that attacks on science as being wasteful will be a part of those efforts. And so what we've done is we put together a selection committee of distinguished scientists and have asked a number of groups and the public for nominations for research that may have seemed funny or odd or obscure at the time it was conducted, but turned out to have extraordinary societal benefit of one kind, whether a benefit to the economy, benefit to health, or other areas of society. And then we've picked a few each year, last year and this year, and honored them in a ceremony here in Washington. This is the second year, and this year, this Thursday, actually, the 19th, is going to be this year's award ceremony here in Washington.
So as you just alluded to, that's really the key criterion for getting one of these Golden Goose Awards, is that the research has to have somewhere down the line paid real dividends in economic or other terms.
That's right. And it needs to have been in some way federally funded. And so it's not likely to be current research, which may fit the first criterion of being seeming odd or obscure, but is too early to fit the second criterion, which of course is having had some major benefit. It's also the Golden Goose Award also tries to honor the sort of the serendipitous nature of science. A researcher is headed down one road, and something that he or she discovers turns out to be something entirely takes them in an entirely different direction, and again leads to some major benefits. So sort of both of those categories are represented in our winners, both from last year and this year.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about this year's winners. One of the winners is actually one of my favorite pet stories in science, and this is the discovery of the enzyme that is now used to replicate and sequence DNA. It's the underpinning of essentially the entire biotechnology revolution, but it came out of basic research into the microbes that inhabit hot springs and other very hot, unusual environments on Earth.
Well, that's right, and that award is going to Drs. Thomas Brock and Hudson Freeze. And Dr. Brock went out to Yellowstone and was essentially looking at these hot springs and saying, well, what kind of microbes are in here that could actually survive that kind of these kinds of extremes? He actually had an undergraduate student named Hudson Freeze. He was actually an undergraduate at the time. And he suggested that he take one of these microbes and research that microbe, and they named this microbe Thermus aquaticus, so that was interesting. They were looking for the qualities that would allow it to survive in this high heat. Well, it turned out that when DNA was discovered and scientists wanted to do research on it, in order to produce significant quantities of it that they could study, they needed the process that it went through, put it through very high heat. Well, it turned out that this particular microbe, the DNA from this microbe, had the enzymes that essentially made this process possible, that enabled them to carry out this process. And this has led to essentially the ability to create the entire biotechnology industry, which of course revolutionized medicine in this country, and now the genomics revolution, which is going to further revolutionize medicine. And so and it all comes out of basically a scientist's curiosity about what you might find in the hot springs of Yellowstone. And so that's one of our Golden Goose Awards this year.
I mean, that must have been such an incredible aha moment to realize, you're trying to figure out how on earth does a microbe survive these incredibly high temperatures, and to suddenly realize, oh, well, the way that they survive in nature could actually solve this problem that we've got here in the lab for how to keep enzymes working at high temperatures for our own purposes. It, as you said, kind of honoring the serendipity and those sorts of aha moments that happen in science.
And Dr. Freeze is still working on those kinds of problems out in San Diego. He is he does research on specific genetic diseases that and his and Dr. Brock's initial discovery is what helped make that research possible.
Now, one of the other winners this year goes to some folks who created a mathematical algorithm that is now used to match kidney donors with non-family members in need of a kidney, but it was originally used, I guess, to optimize hypothetical marriages in a group of people.
Well, that's right. So there are three awardees, Lloyd Shapley and David Gale. David Gale is deceased, and Alvin Roth, who's an economist. So Shapley and Gale, back in 1962, came up with an algorithm that solved a mathematical problem, but one wouldn't see how it solved a real societal problem, at least realistically. Because they took a bunch of theoretical people and said, how can we pair them up so that and create all stable marriages so that no man and no woman are going to like each other more than they like their partner. They might not have gotten the person they wanted most, Okay, they might not have gotten their first choice, but that choice, but they're not going to be more interested in somebody else who's also interested in them.
So there's no better option for both members of a marriage.
Right.
No reason for them to completely split.
Right. There is no such group of people that you can pair up that way. And it sort of, it's all theoretical. The messiness of life is not reflected there. However, it turns out that this federally financed research was actually very useful later on when Alvin Roth took this and said, you know something, we can use this for a couple different things. First, and a couple examples are, there are in several cities, including New York, including Boston, there are school choice programs that allow student families to choose schools. And this algorithm, or a version of this algorithm, was developed by Dr. Roth to match schools with students so that you could maximize people getting their top choice, or a choice that worked for them. Another program that has come out of that Dr. Roth helped create is the program that matches new medical residents coming out of medical school with hospitals. Anybody who knows a young doctor knows that one of the things they do is they apply to see what hospital or other medical facility that they will go to for their first jobs, basically. And those hospitals and facilities are also looking to see the best young men and women that they can get to work for them at their institution.
I mean, with all these...
This algorithm matches them up.
With all these possible important applications in real life, you kind of have to wonder why the researchers originally chose a hypothetical group of people and trying to optimize marriages instead of one of these real-life problems.
Well, they were mathematicians, and that's what they did. They did theory. And as you also alluded to, a subsequent algorithm that they created for different circumstances, the selling of houses in a market that didn't use money, also obviously extremely theoretical, led to the National Kidney Exchange that Dr. Roth helped develop with others. And so the National Kidney Exchange that basically takes, if you have a couple or you have a donor and a recipient, someone who needs a new kidney, someone who would like to give them a new kidney but they're not compatible, their immune systems are not compatible. If you take a lot of people in those same circumstances, you can match them up. And this is what happens right now. The National Kidney Exchange, last year they had the largest such exchange involving 60 people, I believe 30 kidneys, I assume, and from all over the country, people who don't know each other but who were matched up through this program. And so this is how theoretical mathematical work can lead to extraordinary results for society. And what's interesting about this is our first award in the social sciences. And frankly, the social sciences are under attack in Congress. And this is just one of the many examples of how studies in the federally financed research in the social sciences can lead to very important benefits for society.
Now, you've mentioned this federally funded criterion a few times. There was actually another potential winner this year who declined the prize because they couldn't confirm that the research that you wanted to honor was actually federally funded. Why is that aspect of the prize so important?
Truthfully, there's a message here, and I think I've stated it, and I'll restate it, that federally financed research is critical to the country. We're really mainly talking about basic scientific research. Companies, the private sector, really can't afford to do it anymore. There used to be the Bell Labs, which were very famous and did amazing basic research, but the company that AT&T, the company that ran it, was a monopoly. Well, that doesn't exist anymore, and the market does not allow companies, you know, publicly owned companies, to spend a lot of money on basic research. And they really can't afford to, because you don't know where basic research is going to go. And a company has to have some idea that they're going to be able to reap the benefits of basic research. And so most of the federally funded research that takes place is done at universities.
So could is there any way that you think that honoring the basic research that has, in the end, through serendipity or whatever events, ended up having important applications, could honoring those somehow be construed as undermining the probably thousands of other basic research projects that don't show dividends in that way?
Well, we don't know. Well, I guess the point is we never know when something is going to show benefits. It can take decades. And not, of course, not every research project leads to an entire new industry. I mean, we would never make that claim. That's ridiculous. But you don't know what will come out of research, and you don't know how long it will take. For example, one of our awardees last year was Charles Townes, who won the Nobel Prize for his invention of the maser, which became the laser. Now, when the laser he was at Berkeley, and his department was telling him, stop this work, it's ridiculous, it's silly, it's not going to work, and even if it works, so what? What are you going to be able to do with it? Well, he persisted, and the result of that was the maser, again, which then was developed into the laser.
So you never really can tell what's going to happen.
And that was called a solution in search of a problem. And today, there's not much technology that we use today that does not in some way use a laser.
Barry Toive of the Association of American Universities and the Golden Goose Awards. Barry, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks all for listening. I'm Heather Goldstone.